and welcome back to Untold, the podcast where we go behind the scenes to talk about the reality of building a business. As you know, there are many podcasts out there that speak about the heroic growth and the amazing brands that are being built. We try and unpick the tougher times and the learnings that come from those tougher times with our fantastic guests, from founders to business leaders of some quite frankly epic brands. I'm really excited. Today we have a fantastic founder who I've known, we were speaking just before, known for about eight years now. It's Mr. Jeremy May, who is co-founder of Nice Wine. If you don't know Nice Wine, you've been living under a rock. Go out and look for them and pick up a can of their delicious wine. I'm really excited to get into this. Jeremy, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you, mate. Nice to see you.
You too. We're in the deep, dark depths of East London, so I'm really appreciative for you to coming all the way out.
If I didn't know you already, I thought you were trying to kidnap me.
Yeah. One of our guests earlier said he thought I was trying to sell him drugs. Yeah. So. that's a better one. How are you doing, mate? You well?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah.
Good.
It's really nice to be here.
Amazing. Good. Listen, I want to kick off with what we always do. I want to give a bit of colour to our listeners before we kick on to sort of the main topics. To do that, give me a bit of background about you, your career, how you got into food and drink, and then bring us up to sort of meeting Lucy and into the birth of Nice Wine.
Yeah, sounds good. I had a brief stint in financial services in my early 20s, in both London and the Middle East. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, when I was 27, I came back to London. I had a real fork in the road. I'd worked in insurance for a little time. To be honest, absolutely, you know, sick of it. Wasn't interested in it at all. And at 27, I was sitting there thinking, "What am I going to do? What do I want to do?"
Yeah.
And it was really quite fateful how I ended up getting into food and drink.
Yeah.
Through a friend of a friend, an opportunity came up to go and help a really sort of big business look at the opportunity of taking what they did and taking it into export markets. I spoke Spanish, I'd lived in different countries, and so I was offered this like 3-month project to see if I could take a big importer of charcuterie, olives, antipasti, 200 million turnover business, and say, give it a crack and see if you can go sell some of these products to foreign markets.
So,
and especially they had an opportunity in Spain.
Yeah.
So that was a business called Winter Botham Derby. If you've ever eaten any of the products I just mentioned in the UK, you've had it from them.
Wow.
They have both private label and brands.
Amazing.
Chilled,
yeah.
Ambient, everything you can think of. And that was great for me because it was like the start of my entrepreneurship journey, really, because even though I was just a tiny little like project manager on a short-term contract in this big business, I was just given free rein to say, go and do your worst, basically, see
Amazing.
What you can do.
Amazing.
So that was cool. I helped them build. So it started as a 3-month thing and then very quickly gained traction and turned it into about a 5 million turnover business. And then about 2 years later, I got approached by a recruiter who was trying to find an export manager to cover maternity for Fevertree, and I was really interested in it. I'd seen them coming up, and this is like 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
And so I went to meet the founders and got through to the final stage of it, and for whatever reason, you know, it wasn't really a match. But the same recruiter said, "Why don't you go and meet these guys, Proper Corn, as they were known at the time."
Yeah.
And it didn't really make sense to me. I'd never heard of them before because I think they were in their first couple of years still.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, going to meet the founders first hearing about what the revenue was and what number team member I would be. And I was like, God, I'm working a 200 million turnover business with 200 staff. Like, I don't know how this can work out. But I went to meet Cass and Ryan, and like within 5 minutes, I was like, oh my God, I want to work here.
Yeah. Amazing.
They were like real visionaries, and I just immediately bought into what they were doing. I could see they're building this insane culture, and I just wanted it immediately.
Great.
So yeah, I went to essentially create the export or international team for Proper Corn, Proper as they're known now, and that was awesome. You know, I was the ninth employee, I think.
Amazing.
And Again, it was like another step on an entrepreneurial journey. One of the things I remember really clearly that Cassandra said to me in the first meeting was that in my first interview was that she wants to hire entrepreneurs who either want to achieve their entrepreneurial goals within the business or in the future outside of the business.
Yeah.
Either way, she doesn't care. She just wants entrepreneurs in the business. And yeah, I thought amazing. That was really awesome.
Yeah, it's lovely.
So yeah, I was there for 3 years, took that business from, you know, those early stages, selling the first packs of proper corn outside the UK.
Yeah.
So I think by the time I left, the international business was about 25% of the turnover, mm-hmm. and it was a lot of the growth was coming from there as well. So that was great. Took them through a part acquisition, but knew at that point that I wanted to go and see what was next.
Yeah.
So I then set myself up as a freelancer, essentially. I worked out that there were loads of small to medium sized food and drink brands that were all thinking about what to do about export.
Yeah.
Didn't really know where to start and would either not allocate enough resource to it or put a junior person on it or someone else who's doing another job altogether and say, why don't you try and do a bit of exporting? And that never seemed to work for people. So I realized I had this set of skills and knowledge that I could provide to more than one company, if that makes sense.
So definitely.
That's how I started freelancing. And it was through that I met Lucy. So Lucy was on a similar journey. She had run her first business called Cuckoo, ran it for 4 years and then set herself up as a freelancer. So we met through that. And then the third time we had met, we were walking around the lunch trade show. And we basically had both agreed that consultancy for us was not, we were never going to be career consultants.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a means to an end, you know. And it was a great way to like plan what was next. I also got to work with some amazing entrepreneur-led startups and scale ups. And I also spent a year as part of that working on the leadership team at Vita Coco. So I got this amazing, varied experience.
Yeah.
And I just knew it was like, what's my thing going to be? I'm helping other people build their enterprise value here.
Yeah.
And Lucy felt the same. So literally we were walking around the lunch trade show and we said, why don't we do something for ourselves? Let's agree now that we're going to go over to Expo West in America, do a whole market research tour, see if we can find some interesting food and drink trends that were coming from the US or perhaps find a brand that was never going to have the appetite to build a UK and Europe business and essentially joint venture with them. So that was our thinking. But we never got that far because within a week, Lucy had discovered or stumbled across a brand of canned wine in America. It's actually a brand I don't think it's around anymore called The Drop, based in New York.
Yeah.
And she was just like, I've got to do it. Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That occasion for her as a consumer felt that she wasn't being spoken to by any of the brands on the shelf, that the packaging was not functional for its usage occasion, which was on-the-go wine, like little plastic bottles that you don't drink out of for. And so she then kind of pitched it to me and said, this is what I think the thing should be. And I was immediately taken by it as well. For me, it was much more about seeing the what was happening in the adjacent categories. So if you look at what craft beer did for a beer category that was in the doldrums a little bit, and also what craft beer did for the premiumization of alcohol in a can.
Because if you
think back to like when we were growing up, I always used to think if a beer in a can is going to be like low quality, it's going to be warm, probably at a house party at 16,
drinking, stellar,
it's like,
it?
Exactly. And all of a sudden that myth had been completely dispelled. You never think like, oh, is that BrewDog in a can going to be tasty? It's like, of course it is. So, and what was happening in the RTD, like the ready to drink sector of gin and tonics and all these things. And then we just looked at wine and I couldn't believe that it was still being done that way. Like the only reason it's in those little bottles, little plastic or glass bottles, is so that it is identifiable as wine.
Yeah, it's nice.
Like no one drinks out of those.
Yeah.
It's not even functional.
Yeah.
So then you're on the go and you're looking for a little plastic cup to pour it into. Yeah. So sometimes you've got double single use plastic. And it's like, what are we doing?
Yeah. It makes no sense.
Yeah. So, so that's how Nice was born really. And I guess, to that point, it was, we launched cans first, very specifically to address an occasion for wine that we felt was being served really badly.
Yeah.
Which was the on-the-go impulse occasion for wine. Mm-hmm. What we worked out really quickly after launching was that the whole wine industry, there are so many other occasions that aren't well catered for. Wine is often really secondary, a real secondary thing. And it's sort of fragmented in all the wrong places. And it's... in some way sets out to confuse people and intimidate people and like it mystifies people. So that's the thing we want to really try and dispel, put the consumer at the heart of everything we do, yeah. and try and make sure we're addressing like consumer and occasion pain points.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how it began. That was beginning of 2018. And then we launched in February or March 2019. So yeah, we had about a year working on it in the background. That was one of the best things for us was because we were both freelancing, we were able to like allocate time to this little project while also working on other things and continuing to have our own personal incomes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which meant that we could work on Nice for a whole year, all the way up to the point of, you know, literally being ready to launch in Sainsbury's. And we didn't have to raise money to just like cover our own costs.
So we could
build it to a point where we were moving it forward on all fronts, finding investors, building the brand, finding the liquid, finding the co-packer, finding someone to sell it to.
Yeah.
And then only when we had all those things did we stop consulting and we went full time.
Yeah, it's so key. And then that's where that explosive growth has come from, because you fire the gun at a point where you're ready rather than there's a lot of brands out there that fire the gun quite quickly and probably too soon.
We tried to do it. Like, we had the idea in basically January 2018, and I remember sitting around Lucy's kitchen table trying wine in the middle of dry January and saying and literally writing down a timeline, which was this by then and we'll launch in May.
Yeah.
And we got to like midway through February and no one had even responded to our emails. And it's like, what are you talking about? Of course we can't launch a brand in 3 months.
The lead
time just to make cans is 3 months. Like, mental, get out of town. There is value in that. I think there is value in that sort of hustle and like working quickly. And I remember Richard Reed doing a talk at Propercorn once when he said, just start. Like, don't wait till it's perfect, just start. Yeah, yeah. So like, we did that to some extent. It's just we had to be somewhat reasonable.
That launch it in 2 weeks. I think it's hard as well, because in food and drink, certainly if you're not selling it to your local bakery and you're going into Sainsbury's as your first customer, like, there has to be a level of like something that you're proud of. It can't just be like
once we had decided to do it the way we were doing it, which was, you know, create printed cans, like, you need to produce one can, you need to produce 100,000 cans. Doing two variants. So broadly speaking, we were going to have to go and spend £100,000 getting production runs done.
Yeah.
And I don't want to buy £100,000 round and not know who I'm going to sell it to.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
to your
yeah,
point, like,
course.
We had
yeah,
to have yeah. that distribution lined up
yeah, yeah.
in order to make it.
I just want to, just for listeners, when you say printed cans, you mean the full, there's not a sleeve on it.
Exactly. So there's essentially three ways that you can work with cans. You can create labels, which get applied to the can. You can create shrink wrap, which is much harder to tell that it's not essentially a printed can, and then printed cans, which is that the actual ink and branding gets printed onto the can at the point that the can is manufactured.
Amazing.
So yeah,
and there's 100,000 minimum run.
Yeah, I mean, these days they're trying to get you to do 200,000. So yeah,
wow,
exactly. Because one of the challenges that happened through COVID is the demand for cans globally went up 15%. If you imagine, it's not possible to just increase capacity for global can manufacturing by 50%. It's absurd.
Yeah.
So yeah, they suddenly it just got like,
wow,
capacity cans. Yeah,
I knew it was a lot. I didn't realize it was that much. Wow, amazing.
Yeah, it's fun.
At The Savourist, we can't run our own podcast and not talk about our wonderful snacks. We have a range of crunch hits, which are made from edamame, black bean, puff rice. They're bundled together and seasoned with Thai chili or sizzling barbecue. They pack a punch of crunch and are honestly the go-to snack that you should be heading for in your cupboard. They're high protein, they're low calorie, and our mission is to end the healthy, tasty tension. It says it all, really. Healthy snacks that taste absolutely banging. Head on over to our website and grab some. Ta-da! There's so much to unpick in that. I think the biggest thing before we move on is, for me, is finding that need state. Like, you guys, what I've always found really inspiring about what you're building is the way that you talk to your consumer is so bang on. Like, there's a brand there that should have been 20 years in the making that you guys have managed to get out within a couple of years. And from what I unpick from that is, from the very beginning, you knew exactly who you were targeting and why and what the problem was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think partly we have to thank the wine industry, you know, incumbents and the status quo of the wine industry, which, as I said, like it hadn't really had much innovation in either product innovation or brand and branding innovation.
Yeah.
If you think about like the way that beer brands are built and the way that, you know, brands like Innocent and Propercorn and Vitacoco and those kind of brands, like they're such disruptors. They're so kind of different in their approach that's who you would be competing with if you went into those categories.
Yeah, yeah.
In the wine industry, it's like Chateau this and vintage that.
The biggest
innovation is that we stopped putting corks in bottles and started putting screw caps. Like that was like mind-blowing innovation.
Yeah.
And it's been really helpful, but
to
set yourself apart in the wine industry is a little bit easier because the status quo is so over here.
Yeah.
So for us to go over here, and we could take inspiration from all those kinds of brands that I just mentioned.
Yeah.
So I remember going into the first meeting with the Sainsbury's buyer, and at that point we didn't have we had no branding, we had no wine. We basically just had the story I just told you.
Yeah.
And we said, look, there is a need state here for canned wine. This is what's happening in America. It's being led by entrepreneur-led nimble startups, just like the craft beer industry has.
Yeah.
Like if you imagine craft beer was started and it was suddenly Carling Craft, Stella Craft, Foster's, it wouldn't have worked.
Yeah.
So we just said, look, we want to be the Innocent of canned wine or wine.
Yeah,
we want to be the Brewdog of wine.
Yeah.
We want to be the proper of wine. So we had these like inbuilt, we had these like attitude leaders that we could mimic in a category that was just completely undisrupted, essentially.
Yeah, amazing. Mm. I think it's amazing. And I think in that, there's already loads of lessons. And I think having a customer to go to that early on within Sainsbury's, I mean, it obviously helps because you'd both been in the industry before, but for listeners, like having a story, and you can learn a lot when you're talking to a Sainsbury's buyer about whether this is worth spending money on it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of brands out there that will spend a hell of a lot of money on branding and without really looking into, can we sell this? Can you get it off and away? And I think one of the big learnings I had when we first launched bars that don't exist anymore was exactly that. We didn't have a customer sell to, and then Crunchits, we sold to EasyJet before it went into a bag. And it was that exact learning where you're like, you can actually get really quite far without spending huge amounts of money on
That's essentially what happened to us. That, you know, they said, if you do what you say you're going to do, which is to put good quality wine in cans at a price that people are going to be happy to pay, and you create the kind of brand that you're talking about, like, we'll be up for that. We'll be up for a big listing. We want to put you in our future brand scheme, all this stuff.
Amazing.
One of the things, though, that you just talked about there, which I was always really upfront with Lucy about, was that we agreed to work on this. As I said, you know, to begin with, it was a day every couple of weeks, and then it was a day a week, and then, you know, whatever. What I always said was, let's keep checking in on the hurdles we anticipate and what the size of a hurdle needs to look like that we don't want to go over it.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, so, yeah, totally.
You know, like, this is all well and good. I'm happy to spend my time on this. And then I'm happy to go meet some customers and like, okay, now let's spend our own money on getting the branding done, because now we do have some customers interested. But we also, one of the first things we did was bought data. I was talking about my family got no Christmas presents in Christmas 2017 because we spent all that money on buying a one-off Nielsen data report, because I wanted to understand the size of the miniatures wine category.
Yeah.
And the size and growth of the RTD sector, so gin and tonics, all those things.
If
that data had told me that there was not a big enough addressable market, like I kept saying to Lucy, if that's not big enough, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
If we can't find a customer, a big nationwide grocer, basically, we're not going to do it. Like I'm not going to, or if we can't find investors, and we have to go down a certain route that we don't want to go down, no, we're not doing it.
We kept
agreeing that like, what will be that hurdle? And once we reach it, if we can't get over it, then it's okay. We can just like, I'd rather fail fast.
Than 100%, 100%.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And I think actually what you, like, by putting that at the forefront of your mind, you're probably actually giving yourself more of a leg up to get over the hurdle because you're identifying it earlier. So therefore you're identifying how you get over it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And also you're setting yourself up, at least I think, to be as objective as possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, our thing was, if we can't find a meaningful sized customer, we're not going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
Because if we can't find one before we have the stock all.
Yeah.
Why are we suddenly going to find one afterwards?
Yeah.
Then we're just like playing with fire then.
Yeah.
So we were lucky that Sainsbury's were really interested.
Yeah.
We didn't at that point then have to go and meet all the other retailers. But had we exhausted all the other retailers, we definitely wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, definitely.
But that speaks to your point again is, you know, knowing that you've got like putting the bait in the water and seeing if someone will nibble is so helpful.
Yeah.
You can have as much, as many pitch decks as you want and as much gut instinct as you want, like the proof's going to be in the pudding.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Mm. And in our case, eating or drinking, right?
Exactly, so yeah.
I think it's really interesting because we've had a couple of guests who have come on who don't have previous experience of food and drink, and then some that have. And I think that putting it in the water and getting the nibble, having that experience to even know how to get hold of a Sainsbury's buyer, I know that sounds ridiculous, but like is so key because it's having the kahunas to just be like, go and speak to somebody first.
Yeah.
Or go and get in the room with somebody in order to get that. And I think there's a lot to be said about the experience that you have had pre-starting NICE that probably aided that as well.
Definitely, yeah. As you said, knowing how to get in the room is the first thing.
Yeah.
And that is a combination, I think, of like knowing the tactics and then also having something interesting to talk about.
Yeah.
Had we been peddling, I don't know, I don't want to undermine anyone else's businesses, so something boring.
Yeah.
That they'd already had plenty of times before.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have got in the room.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether we've worked in other places or know the right tactics to get
them
interest.
Of course. It's a hand-in-hand play, isn't it?
Exactly,
I think there's a lot that's quite complicated about food and drink, and it becomes very obvious when you know what it is. But that's like everything in life, right? It's like once you start learning, you know where to go. So on Untold, you know, and our listeners know that we want to talk about the more challenging times. Like this podcast started from a Sainsbury's listing and driving around doing compliance stores. And it was like the 30th, 20th, that number seems to go up every time I tell the story. 20, it was the 20th store of the day, sat in the car park. And I was like, well, this is really shit. I'm driving around literally to make sure we're on shelf. I haven't got money to pay an agency. Like, why is no one talking about this side? All we're getting is a glamorous side. So that it was born out of that, and it was born out of wanting to kind of wrap our arms around each other and go, look, people do go through shitty times and this is how I got through them. So I want to come on to you. I know pre-hitting record, we were having a chat about sort of what this conversation might look like, and you said that you had just recently spoken to your team about this exact topic. Talk me through what that looked like and where that came from.
So in a way we're in quite a privileged and lucky position that over the last 18 months in particular we've faced much less adversity, still loads of challenging times, don't get me wrong, but we've had a really great period of sort of growth and wins and starting to build the team and, you know, really like really good momentum. In February this year, for the first time in ages, like we pride ourselves really a lot on doing what we say we're going to do,
especially
to investors and whoever it might be, our board. Like if we set a target and a budget, we're going to do it. Like the last 3 years in a row, we've overachieved against budget. Yeah, I've never worked in a company where we've done that before.
That
was a learning. Like we want to be ambitious but achievable in these targets.
Yeah.
Because it's so important for me for momentum.
Well, your word then means something, right?
Exactly. Future. So in February this year, through a combination of honestly, like slightly probably punchy forecasting, a little bit of phasing, and you know, one or two things like falling to either side of the wrong day of the month.
Yeah.
But generally, for the first time in a long time, we had a revenue miss in February.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like the beginning of the year. We've had pretty crappy weather, haven't we? And And as a wine business, like I've become a part-time weather forecaster because when the sun shines, the rosé sells.
Yeah.
So, you know, and just generally, I think even things like the narrative in the media, just more generally outside the business, like you can get into a bit of a lull of like, God, it's going to be a tough year, and inflation's still there, interest rate, all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but most people, you know, the majority of our team have been with us for 2 years or less. And so, I could see that it was starting to affect people because we place so much emphasis on hitting numbers, for example, that like having a revenue miss in February, you know, I felt like it was dragging people down a little bit. Yeah. So yeah, I spoke to Lucy about this last week and said, you know, we need to kind of make sure, first of all, that we aren't, you know, that it's not all rose-tinted glasses. Like you have to, you know, if we've had a miss, we have to own it, understand why, and then it's how we react to it. That's the big difference. And so in our team meeting on Tuesday, I probably for the first time ever, like needed to, what I felt like, give a bit of a rousing speech, was just to say, look, most of you haven't really had to experience, you know, missing numbers or going through a really challenging scenario. And I just want to explain a few examples where we've had really tough stuff happen to us in the past. Like before, you know, before you guys worked here, we went through, and I'll talk about it in a second, but we went through, you know, this specific challenge and this specific challenge, which were like existential threats to us.
Yeah.
And, but we overcame them, like with a combination of pragmatism, prudence, leaning more into our values of like hustle, work, do everything in dog years, culture as a team game. Like these are themes that you'll always hear coming out of any podcast or anything, any output from us. And what I said, and the main point I said was, great businesses, great leaders, great teams will nearly always be judged on how they deal with adversity rather than how they thrive in good times. So everyone can, like, when things are good, everyone can do well, right? It's how you address and react to like really challenging scenarios. Like don't bury your head in the sand. Let's acknowledge what's failing, what's not working.
Yeah.
Let's work through it and let's find the answers.
Yeah.
See what I mean? So,
Definitely.
And so that, I think people in our business needed to be reminded of that, because loads of businesses are going through that all the time.
Yeah.
Like we're the outlier, I would say.
Yeah. 100%.
Over the last 18 months, certainly we are the outlier, that we hit every target. We beat budget last year. We almost tripled in size. And it's been win after win.
Yeah.
And as soon as you have one moment of adversity, you can't suddenly let that be like, oh my God, you know, everything's falling apart. to share those, I guess, experiences, which I shared with the team yesterday about like real life challenges that we had, in the times before we started to build a team. The first was when we first launched with Sainsbury's. They gave us an amazing listing. They gave us a 600 store listing. 150 of those stores were convenience stores. And that was a big thing for me. If we weren't going into convenience, we were not going to prove the impulse occasion for canned wine. We were going to disprove it. If you just chuck canned wine in the back of store in the ambient section, that's not going to prove the concept. It's going to more likely disprove it.
Yeah.
So I was really big on that. And so we launched, lo and behold, 30% of our revenue was coming through our top 3% of stores, which are all convenience. Amazing. And I was like, you get us into that top distribution, we're going to fly off shelf.
Yeah.
We had 100 cans going out a week in our highest selling store.
Fucking hell.
And that's the same as having like 100 back of store mainstay stores, right, at that point. So it's so valuable. And so we really hit the ground running with it. And we had our two SKUs in, our Pale Rosé and our Sauvignon Blanc. And all of a sudden, one day I walk into a store, I'm like, what's this brand? And so the buyer who launched us had moved on and a new buyer had come in and suddenly we see that this new brand has landed on shelf. It's called Vandra. I don't mind naming it.
Yeah.
And they'd launched 5 SKUs. So in a category that's totally in its infancy, they'd launched 2 white, 2 red in cans, the first canned red wine, and 1 rosé alongside our range. So you've gone from having no still wine in cans to having 7 SKUs.
Oh, my word.
And worse than that, they had taken all of our top distribution. So those top 50 stores, they had gone in there and replaced us. And I remember the moment it really hit me was I walked into a store that I personally had been in 2 weeks before to put up some shelf edge label, or like a shelf barker, which said it was pink, it had our pale rosé on it, and it said wine in a can, it's a thing.
Yeah.
And that was still up, but our cans had been replaced this tertiary brand, right? So and the story about it goes is that the buyer who had essentially listed these products had then moved to the supplier of this new brand. So So I don't know whether they were breaking G Scott rules or whatever it was. Yeah. It was like, it was sort of, you know, I don't hold that against the buyer.
Yeah, yeah.
That was their prerogative.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, to say, oh, okay. And who knows, you know, how skullduggerous that was, we'll never know. Yeah, maybe it happened completely naturally, which I probably imagine it did.
Yeah.
But here I am staring down the barrel of, you know, as I've just explained for the last however long, that big distribution was what we needed to build this business.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's got taken away from us.
Yeah.
And then that, as I said, that buyer then moved. So we had a new buyer who babysat it for a few weeks, and then a fourth buyer. So within 6 months, we've had four buyers in Sainsbury's.
Yeah, wow.
And they've now inherited a situation that was not of their doing, but they now have two brands on shelf. So this brand Vandra had been created for Sainsbury's. It was essentially what we refer to as a tertiary brand, right? Mm. So it wasn't a Sainsbury's own label, but it was only in Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
And so we'd done all the heavy lifting to try and build the category. We were in all the newspapers. We'd done a big press outreach. We were building social media. We getting out in store, like doing all the work you were just talking about.
Yeah.
And then they've just come and swept up our distribution. But new buyer in place, they said, well, I'm sorry that you went through that, but here I am. I've got two brands and one of you's going to win. That was like such a big existential threat to us.
Wow.
And they were, and this brand had come from a much bigger wine business than us, obviously. We were still just in our infancy.
Mm.
They make loads of other wine products. They sell loads of other wine products to Sainsbury's. Like, it was David and Goliath.
Yeah,
and that was such an existential threat to us. And I just remember saying to Lucy, like, you know, what are we going to do? We're literally, we took all this momentum, we're just launching, and then suddenly the carpet is pulled from beneath us.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, to the point I was just making, we had to, it was an absolute slog. And I ended up building a really amazing relationship with the buyer. And he was just super clear cut with us. He was like, look, by this date, and this is now during COVID as well. So by this date, I'm going to be making a decision on which of these brands stay in. You know, there's no doubt you guys are doing XYZ and are much more disruptive than they are. But like, the cost of goods of them is lower because all the economies of scale I just talked about.
Yeah.
And obviously we were making the argument to the hilt. It's like this category is in its shopper recruitment phase. This isn't like about launching low value. Like, that's dragging the category down. You'll kill the category with this behavior, but you are where you are. I get it. Like, so we did a whole load of things. Like, we got out in store. We met all made friends with loads of store managers. Like, we had the top, we started to try and get like stock into stores which used to buy it, which didn't now. And like, really like bending the rules of what's really allowed within Sainsbury's. But we just fought like fuck.
Yeah.
And,
amazing.
And as I said, I built this amazing relationship with the buyer whereby I would like manage his expectations. I'm like, look, I'm not going to speak to you for 6 weeks, but when I come back to you in 6 weeks time, here's what I want to talk about. And I'll leave you alone during that. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's where the benefit came in, I think, of having experience in this, in this industry. It was like, we think this is the most important thing ever to happen in the world.
Yeah.
This buyer, we are probably one of 20 suppliers that we work with, and we are probably less than 1% of the volume. We're such a speck on his shoe. Do you know what I mean?
So
to be as painless as possible to him, but like give him an answer, give him, don't give him the opportunity to say no to it.
Yeah.
So that was like such an existential risk to us. And I spent 6 months, literally, that was like my number one thing, was making sure that didn't go to shit, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then the second challenge we went, so that was loads of adversity, but I'm lucky enough to say, or we're lucky enough to say that like the outcome of it was really good.
Yeah.
But it took a lot of work, and it was really challenging. And they got delisted, and we took the lion's share of their distribution, and amazing. I would never look back.
Great.
Amazing.
And you're so right. I think that that category would have been killed if it wasn't you guys or like leading the charge in that challenge away.
Yeah.
Hi all, just quickly, I want to introduce you to my friends at Spring & Tonic PR, who are also this series podcast sponsors. They are my own trusted PR partners for the Savouris. What I love about Spring & Tonic is it's run by two wonderful ladies, Emily and Jess. They're a small but mighty team. It is just the two of them, and thanks to years in the industry, they completely understand the startup, scale-up, food and drink space, and how to get meaningful cut-through in consumer and trade media. Having worked with some of the most successful and exciting names in food and drink, they really are an industry go-to. So if you're looking to make tangible difference to your business, build your brand equity through PR, I honestly would look no further. Get in touch with them at Spring & Tonic PR to find out more. Ta! I guess you don't switch off for 6 months then, right? For you personally.
It was COVID. So yeah. It was a weird time anyway. Like you, as much as you wanted to get out of store, you couldn't get out of stores.
Yeah.
I'll come on to talk about all the other challenges we had. And like, I've got a second sort of anecdote to say, yeah, which will feed into this a little bit, which is that the whole hospitality sector had gone to sleep. So, you know, we were expecting that year to be 50% of our revenue was going to come from the on-trade or the essentially like festivals, events, music, events, all this sports stadia, all of it was gone for a year.
Yeah.
So combined with that and the fact that Lucy and I have always been really, we've always set out to ensure that like running the business doesn't consume our lives. So we never wear like being busy as a badge of honor. I'm like allergic to it.
Yeah.
You'll never hear me say I'm really busy.
Yeah.
Ever.
Great.
Even if there's lots going on.
Yeah.
I don't like the narrative of that.
Yeah.
And also we purposely don't work great. We set an example by like not working 18-hour days and things like I don't really buy into like Gary V's world.
No,
if you're not doing five jobs, terrible. You're an idiot.
What are you talking about? Yeah.
But it definitely consumes you. Like if there's that kind of stuff going on, I'll wake up loads during the night. It's the first thing I think of. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so
it's that level of stress where it's just constantly whirring in the background.
Yeah.
I don't intend to let it consume me, but when that stuff's going on, you can't help.
Of course, right? Yeah, it's your business.
Exactly. And so that definitely was challenging. And then the second example, or the second kind of anecdote I shared with the team and share with you now as well, which we talked about the other day, this isn't going to be any. Everyone went through stuff like this, right? So COVID hits. We are at the time it was myself and Lucy and one other team member, who was our brand manager essentially at the time. And I remember we were in our office in Angel. We were on the NatWest Accelerator program. We're sitting there on the Monday or something, and it's murmuring Italy's being a bit weird. Italy's gone into lockdown, and our team member was actually away for 2 weeks on holiday at the time. And we said maybe we should just like not come into the office the next couple of days and see what's what.
Yeah.
Well, we never went back there.
Wow. Yeah.
And so we go from like, I wonder what's going to happen, to suddenly, oh my God, we're in lockdown.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's illegal to leave the house.
Yeah.
And then we're about to do Cheltenham. We were about to have our wine at Cheltenham races, which actually did happen.
Yeah.
And then Wimbledon was a few weeks later. So we had just won the contract to supply Wimbledon tennis.
Amazing.
They had just placed a 50 grand order. We've produced it all. And then suddenly it's like, oh, we're in lockdown now. I wonder if so. We're in March, April, you know, June, will maybe Wimbledon happen this year? It didn't even happen the following year. You know what I mean? So like we were wondering whether it was going to happen that year. It didn't even happen the following year. So all of a sudden we're like, holy fuck, what are we going to do? And you know, so in many ways we're a little bit lucky because we had raised money not long before that. So from a capital perspective, we were okay.
Yeah.
We also hadn't gone on that journey of starting to sort of deploy loads of capital into things you can't back out of, like hiring or you know, marketing campaigns that we couldn't back out of. So we were just quite fortunate that came along at a time where we could quite easily like batten down the hatches. But before Rishi Sunak even came out with the famous furlough scheme, I was trying to devise one of my own. I was thinking, right, we've got this team member who's going to come back from holiday in 2 weeks, and one of the things we did immediately was just like pause any meaningful marketing spend.
Yeah.
So look, what are we going to get a brand manager doing for the next weeks, months? How long do we know? Like, I wonder whether we can essentially appeal to her to say, like, what about if we try and move you to 3 days a week for a while? Like, what is your minimum? You know, when none of us are allowed to leave the house.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the minimum amount of money we need to pay you live. To live? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because we don't want to make any, like, we don't want to change anything. But
of course, yeah.
So all that stuff we're thinking about. And then luckily the furlough scheme comes along, which allows us to. So Rishi was just a couple of weeks behind me on that one. But but then the next thing we did, we said, all right, well, all this stuff's gone away. The only silver lining to us, like all businesses in our space, was e-commerce suddenly started happening.
Yeah.
But what we agreed was, well, how are we going to cash conserve during this time? And I'm sure Lucy won't mind me sharing this, but so what we decided to do, we said, right, I'm gonna continue to work like on nothing else.
Yeah.
And we're going to reduce our salaries to a similar basis, right? We didn't need, you know, we were able to because you couldn't do anything with your money. So
yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah.
So we agreed that Lucy would go back to some of her consulting clients and start to essentially try and make some income that way.
Yeah.
And that she wouldn't draw any salary until basically she had burned through whatever cash she was able to earn from consulting.
Yeah.
And it was really nice. One of the things that happened at the time was we sort of ummed and ahed about to what extent to inform all of our investors about that taking place, you know, because one of the things we had agreed with all our investors when we started work, you know, when we raised money was that we were going to leave our consulting businesses behind. Like we would be all in on NICE from 2019 onwards.
Yeah.
And so we sort of explained it. We're obviously in crisis mode and we explained to our investors on an email and said, look, this is what we're planning to do. And the amount of feedback we had that was so positive, it was like, you're doing the absolutely right thing. Like, amazing on Lucy for agreeing basically to go and put herself to work and deny, you know, and refuse any salary from the business. Yeah. And it really felt like a sort of wartime behavior, which COVID felt, didn't it?
It was.
And
like the budget, like that day when Sunak came out of budget, it was a wartime budget.
I'll never forget it. I had a lump in my throat when he stood up there and said, like, basically, we're going to come save you all.
Yeah.
I remember thinking, God, you know, I know
this is real.
He hasn't covered himself in glory since, but in that moment, he was, you know, the nation's sweetheart.
Well, he was a lifeline.
And so we were all feeling like that about loads of stuff, weren't we? And that's like another classic example where we went from having all these great plans to suddenly, well, Lucy, you're going to go and try and do as much consulting as you can.
Yeah.
She didn't take a penny out of the company for well over a year.
Wow.
Which is amazing, really. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
And
what comes out of that as well, which I'm sure you'll come on to, but I'm sure has happened, is like, I guess that must have been such an amazing relationship to learn early on in terms of what you communicate to your investors as well.
Yeah.
Which has probably held you in really fucking good stead. Like, how much detail do you go into? It's not always just the glorified bits. You've got to show them a reality, because if you want them to be in the trenches with you, fucking give them the ammunition to be there, right?
We do quarterly updates to our investors by email, and we've never had one go out that doesn't have a challenges section.
Yeah.
So like we try and be as objective and honest as we can in those updates, because we're lucky as well. We get to have an amazing cap table of individuals, many of who have been entrepreneurs in their own right. So like, they know what we're going through.
Yeah,
they're not unrealistic to think that everything can be rosy all the time.
Yeah.
And I think they appreciate that. And as you say, it has it's given us the encouragement to make sure we're just always kind of respecting that view, which is like, let's make sure that we're being open and honest about as much about the good times as we are about the things that are difficult for us.
Yeah, amazing. Mm. Amazing, man, I love it. And I think that both of those bits really show the hurdles that you come from. It's very easy to sit there we've spoken to a couple of people about this, where like you see the explosive, not you guys specifically, but just brands that have had explosive growth. And out of hundreds of challenger brands, there's like on like one hand you can count the brands in the last 10 years that have really nailed it, of which NICE is from an outsider looking in is one of those brands that has really started to kick off. And I think it's gonna be really beneficial for the listeners to know that, look, like, it doesn't matter what size you're at, everyone goes through it, right? And for you to have to pull your team back and go, hold on a second, there are bad times, is so much credit to you and Lucy for giving them the tools to go off and do their job in a way that they do, where they don't have to worry about it, but to pull it back and get the learnings from it is amazing. And I guess culturally that's really helped. Like I've admired the culture that you guys have built from the out, from what, I mean, I've never worked in your business, but from what is an outward facing culture, I've really admired it. I think the not shying away from the hustle culture is one where I think is brilliant, because it's nailed into what the hustle is rather than what the hustle is the Gary V way. Do you know what I mean? I think it's great. So it must talk me through that though. How so you've spoken to your team. What was the sort of reception to that chat? Did it go down well?
Well, slightly annoyingly, it just happened to be one of those team meetings where it was only me and one other person actually in the office. So because it's Easter and there's a couple of people off, and then there's a couple of people who have like either gone home and who are working from home. So it was, it almost felt a bit COVID-y, like talking to my screen a little bit. But I think it was really positive. And I spoke to a couple of people afterwards, and the general sentiment was exactly that, which is like, A, it's nice to hear and be reminded that like dealing with those challenges that's the thing that's going to set you apart.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So yeah.
We need 100%. To think about all of this stuff basically as a positive. I know it sounds a bit insane.
No, not at all.
But like the motivating factor here should be like, we are going to smash it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. And the obstacle's the way, right? You've got to go through those moments. To your point, and I love that sort of analogy of like what hurdle is going to be too big.
Yeah.
And I guess even if you're still in that mindset now, you're like, you're always going to be able to jump a hurdle, right? Because you know that it's coming.
To some extent, yeah. Like if you know what they are, then, and you see them coming from far enough away, then I think you should have the time and essentially the time to react and like work out how you are going to deal with it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That said, I'm also such a big advocate of if for whatever reason that doesn't happen. So let's say you just don't get a chance to not see it coming. Yeah. Let's say you run a bar and it's all going swimmingly and then COVID happens.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There isn't really much... there isn't much pivoting from that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a tap tackle.
You're going to be shut. Yes, yeah. You're going to be shut for a year.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
And like sometimes there's no doubt that if you don't get time basically to deal with, you know, to see that iceberg coming.
Yeah.
I have so much respect for people who are prepared to say, "Oh, we failed." You know what I mean? And say that's happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something I've always been really open and really upfront with investors about, is that our hope and intention is that we can get a nice big exit from this business and find a partner who wants to buy us and like, you know, sail off into the sunset.
Yeah,
but
yeah, of course.
Doesn't happen for every business.
No.
I've seen some really good examples, I think, of people who have like taken a business as far as they can go and then say, a great example, and I hope they don't mind me sharing this because I think they wore this with real pride, is the founders of Sandals.
Yeah. We had Hugh on the podcast talking about it.
Yeah, so Hugh's such a good guy. Yeah. And I don't know him really well, but anytime I've ever met him, he comes across as such a good guy. And I remember seeing when they were very, overt in announcing that they had decided to stop trading, essentially.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really quite inspiring to see people being really open about saying, gave it a bash, didn't really work for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Might find in five years time, Sandals comes back and it's like the right time in the right space, whatever.
Yeah.
I just think 100%. That's so.
I think there's so much more to failure than what society allows people to think of failure.
Another example of it, and I'm sure she won't mind me sharing it because she talks about it with great pride as well, is Lucy's first business. You know, she was, we've talked about how helpful it is to be founders that have experience in the industry. The first time she did it, she was the complete opposite. She was straight out of university. Her and a friend decided to launch a Bertram Muesli breakfast pot business called Cuckoo. I'm going to paraphrase, like the things she always says about this is, it was a 17-day shelf life chilled product, which I'll never fucking do again. And she explains that they had lots of highs, lots of lows, ran it for 4 years and got some amazing listings, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, I think Tesco's as well. But after 4 years, they sold the business, but it wasn't a glamorous exit. It was on a journey to not working.
Yeah.
And essentially they sort of exited stage left.
Yeah, nice.
And it wasn't glamorous. And but it set herself, it set Lucy up for having a consulting business for a start. And then starting Nice, and like all those learnings she had from being a first time, first hand entrepreneur, I had to slightly learn secondhand. Like I had to learn them sitting next to the entrepreneurs who were starting the businesses.
Yeah.
She did it herself. So I think that's another example where wearing that failure with pride and moving on to the next thing is really admirable.
Quick one, I really want to talk to you about Bread and Jam. It's the UK's biggest community of food and drink founders and proud supporters of the Untold podcast. They run workshops, talks, network events and conferences that support emerging and scaling food and drink FMCG brands. Their main event, the jewel in their crown, is the Bread and Jam Festival in London each July. It's 2 days of jam-packed peer-to-peer knowledge, sharing where you can, learning from industry icons, meeting retailers, face-to-face pitching sessions, finding industry experts who can take your business to the next level, and the network till you drop. I have been the last few years and I honestly cannot tell you how wonderful this event is. It oozes positivity, the energy in there is electric, and I've met some wonderful people there. I've had the privilege of sharing and chairing a couple of sessions there, and the whole thing is honestly, honestly, honestly unbelievable value for the cost of the ticket. Head over to their website, Bread and Jam, and I really hope I'll see you there. We are hosting an Untold live podcast from Bread and Jam this summer at the festival. So do come along and see us. And I really, really hope you guys sign up, because I honestly cannot explain how wonderful the event is. Cheers, guys. I think also when you look at like the challenger brand world, and when you look at like the generation that's come through, really the challengers that really kicked it off in our sphere is your Pippa Nuts, your Jimmy's Iced Coffees and your Mojis, right? And pre that, the ones that as challengers we see and talk about, I'm sure there were loads before, but pre that you didn't, the wave of challenger brands came with those brands. So it hasn't been long enough for food and drink challengers really to get to a point where businesses have started to fail. And it's only now where it's been long enough time that businesses have tried it, it's not worked, and then they've come out and been like, I've given it a good bash, off we go, and we'll do something else. And then like, you'll sit to your point, like Hugh will be back with something at some point for sure. Like, and another amazing example of that is Hugh Thomas from Ugly. Like he speaks so eloquently about that and that whole process. And he's been through an unbelievably amazing and then incredibly rough journey, but he's out the other side and he's back, and it's amazing to see that journey and him come back.
For sure, I think Hugh's stock has never been higher than having built a business that got to the kind of distribution it did and the kind of notoriety it did.
It's amazing.
So that is, as you say, that's like such a great example of like, if that one doesn't work, like
and it's all built on optimism and hope and hustle, and like no one sits there and goes like, Jimmy's Iced Coffee isn't built because Jim knew exactly what the fuck he was going to do. Like it's not a reflection on a founder or a person.
I was referencing yesterday as well, or Tuesday, whenever it was, which was yesterday, the businesses you remember, like you don't really remember the ones that try and fail and go away, but the ones that really stand the test of time are the ones that deal with adversity in the best way.
Yeah.
So I know again from like firsthand from the founders of Innocent, who came to chat to us a few times when I was at Proper. They went through like an existential crisis. I can't remember exactly when it was, and I think it was around the time that Coca-Cola first got involved with their business, which was like fruit prices would have doubled, let's say. Man. And like the, and unlike now, when inflation and food inflation in particular is front page news.
Yeah.
In that time, no one would have cared. Like, consumers wouldn't have understood. You can't just double my cost of my orange juice. What the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
I don't understand what's going on in global fruit markets. Yeah. Like,
I just want some orange juice.
What are you talking about? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So they went through absolute existential threats. And I think they're pretty open about the fact that like the company was right on the brink of failure. But look at them now. They sold for $500 million or £500 million.
Yeah, it's bad.
Same happened at Vita Coco. Like, Vita Coco is an amazing business. And in the early days in the UK, they were very much like that North Star for all the kinds of businesses that have come after them, Propercorn included.
Yeah.
They built, like, Giles Brooke is an amazing leader. He took a thing that was working in the US already and just applied like his nous and culture and hustle and expertise to it. And they were just building this absolute rocket ship. When I went to work there for less than a year to help them essentially run their Europe, Middle East, Africa business through a time of sort of change management, essentially.
Yeah.
It was really difficult time. Like, the coconut water category suddenly went downwards after a bit of a price war in the UK. Mm. They had been close to an exit, I believe. And then that kind of went away for the same reasons, all sorts of reasons. And then the plan now was like, right, let's plan an IPO. What's that going to look like?
Yeah, pretty cool.
Like, yeah. I worked there during a time, as I said, where it was sort of taking stock. Let's do the things we do well, let's focus on making the main thing, you know what I mean? Like, innovation, all this stuff. Right, let's get back to our core, let's get back to our roots.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, a year later, they IPO'd.
Amazing.
And although I think they initially had they IPO'd at a certain level and it came down a bit, they're now back above their pre-IPO, you know, their initial launch share price. Amazing. Which is a pretty cool story. Like, yeah, again, they went through big downs and, you know, all sorts of challenges.
Well, it's the reality, isn't it? Like, it's never gonna just be like that, or I mean, if it's flat, you're dead, right? So it's like, and how about, I want to come on to you as a founder. Are you enjoying the process? Are you enjoying obviously you're enjoying the business, right? But talk me through that sort of journey.
No, I really do, and a lot of what I've said already, I think, is a big reason for that. So, I really try and not have it overwhelm me or consume me.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do it on my own.
Yeah.
I think having a co-founder, I'm only speaking from experience because that's my experience.
Of course,
I think doing it on my own would be really difficult. Like, having Lucy, I think one of the best things about our business and certainly my time as a founder, a co-founder, is the relationship Lucy and I have.
Mm.
It's like the perfect balance of, we can say whatever the fuck we want to each other.
Yeah.
I consider it a bit like a brother-sister relationship.
Yeah,
like, we don't have any need for pleasantries or, hey, how you doing? It's just like, she can text me at 3 o'clock in the morning, say, I think we should do this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I've been thinking that as well.
Yeah.
Or, I disagree, but let's talk about it in the morning.
It's very good.
And like, it takes work. You know, I'll share an example. About three years ago, we decided to make one of our values as a business that direct feedback is our love language.
Yeah.
We had been through some like situations where, you know, we found it hard to give feedback to employees, or that they also found it hard to take it and they weren't very good at giving it to us. And there are even times where Lucy and I probably didn't speak up enough to each other to be like, hang on, I've got to tell you, you did that wrong there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And one of the first times Lucy did it to me was brilliant. We were meeting an industry veteran who actually became our chairman, or has become our chairman, Shalen Patel.
Amazing.
And we went into the meeting, me, Lucy, and Shalen, and he asked loads of questions, and I'm a real people pleaser, so I wanted to answer every question, and I thought I did a great job at it. And we came out of the meeting, and Lucy said, I just need to tell you, I felt like a bit of a spare part in there, like, you didn't let me speak.
Mm.
I was like, oh my God, I thought I was doing the right thing, whereas you're totally right.
Yeah.
I like cut in to answer every question, and I wanted to appear knowledgeable, and actually what I did is I completely alienated you out of the meeting. I was like, I'm so sorry. And then we agreed literally from that day on, we would always be just so upfront with each other about feedback, whatever it might be. And we always acknowledge that it doesn't come naturally to most human beings to give or take feedback.
Yeah.
Right. So, it makes us all somewhat uncomfortable. Some people are better. It comes more naturally to some than others. But if you just acknowledge that on the whole, the average human is not very good at doing it either
definitely.
Way.
Yeah.
Then we would even like raise our hands and go, oh, direct feedback alert. Like, I'm about to say something that I'm uncomfortable with. Yeah. That's going to make you uncomfortable as well. Nice. But here it is.
Yeah.
I always use the metaphor or the, whether it's a metaphor, I don't know, but I consider it very similar to if you and me were to hang out and have breakfast together, and you would have something in your teeth. If I say to you, oh, you've got something in your teeth, mate. Right. In that moment, it's a bit awkward for me and it's very awkward for you. Your immediate reaction is to be like, oh God. But what's worse?
It gets
to the end of the day, right? And you see that you've got something in your teeth that you know is part of your breakfast and you think, no one told me about that.
Yeah.
And I've been doing it all day.
Yeah.
And that is my example of why direct feedback's really important. And yeah, I can't.
Yeah, mate. No, I think it's so true. And I think it's really refreshing approach because and actually listening to you talk about it like that, it's more about the kind of, it's okay, I'm going to give you feedback here.
Yeah, exactly.
Hold on, listen up. I'm going to give you rather than like, I think I heard it on another podcast or I heard someone speak about direct feedback. And initially I was like, are they just going in on each other the whole time? But it's not, it sounds like it's that like, I'm basically giving my permission to tell you that I don't like something, which I love.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And people are more than within their, you know, within their rights to say, I take some of that on board, but here's also why I did some of it. You know, it's always a discussion.
It's a really lovely like bookender of being like, we're going to talk about it and then we move on.
Exactly.
And
so
I love that, man. Yeah. I think it's really cool.
So meandered there a little bit away, but what I was basically explaining is that, really enjoying being a co-founder. Don't think I could do it. I owe a lot of it to Lucy, and without sounding arrogant, I think she would say the same thing. Being on the journey together is way better than any other option. As I said, you know, we still make plenty of time to go on the holidays we want to go on, spend time with our families, like do all the things we want to do. Like, I think it's a real hiding to nothing. If you don't enjoy the journey, then you end up way too beholden to the outcome.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
You know, so it's like, I've got to build this business and unless I sell it,
that's so bleak. Yeah,
like,
you're
enjoying it and building a great business, the rest will take care of itself.
Oh my God, 100%, completely agree. Because if you did that on life, it would be like...
So bad.
You're in a box.
Your deathbed would be like,
Like, I finally completed it. Yeah, mate, no, I completely agree. I think it's really refreshing. I think it's really, really nice to hear. Look, we can't have you on... after what's just happened with you guys and not talk about the fundraise, like conscious of time. So, give us a, I love the angle that you guys took on this fundraise and we spoke about it very briefly yesterday, day before yesterday. Talk us through that journey.
Yeah. So, I'll go right back to the moment that we decided that actually it was going to be a good idea to raise money. So a couple of things had happened for us. One is, over time, I won't bore you too much of the details, but over time, we've always been lucky to actually be able to rely on like a positive working capital model, which means that we pay for our production on average after we get paid for having sold it, right?
Good.
So it's been amazing, yeah. And that's thanks to a partnership we've had with a wine agency who is an equity partner in our business.
Yeah.
So that's always been amazing. You know, like 105 average, age payables, whatever, age receivables.
Yeah.
Confused I see there.
Yeah.
Just amazing situation to be in. But at very short notice, it got taken away from us because essentially what we were doing is we were leveraging their invoice finance facility.
Yeah.
So when they're back, when we got too big of a proportion of their overall revenue, their bank said, these guys have now gone over X% of your total debtor book. So we're going to need to see their reported accounts. They're an intentionally loss-making business. That doesn't really work for us. Suddenly, overnight, denied from that working capital model. Fine for us at the time because, that didn't put us in a tricky position in that moment. But what it meant was it's always that working capital model has already always allowed us to not face growing pains. Like as we get, bigger and bigger, bigger orders, it means we've never had to worry about...
Oh, mate, it's dreamy. It's amazing.
So in its absence, we were suddenly like... So the other thing I was going to mention is we had extensive discussions with our chairman at the time. Our chairman, during those times, sort of latter end of summer. And, you know, this is when interest rates started going up, debt markets suddenly started becoming a nightmare, all the things we've seen playing out in the press. And what became fairly clear at the time was, like, if you're in a process already, or you could raise the money fairly quickly, like, get it done and wrapped up. Yeah. If not, probably the best thing to do is wait until all this uncertainty, you know, blows over.
Mm.
And, you know, if you can get through to next summer without having to raise money or whatever it looks like, you know, that's probably the way to go. And we thought, well, we're just in pretty good situation, like, and let's go for that option. And then suddenly this working capital model thing happens. It's like, oh, do you know what? That's a bit annoying, because all things considered, maybe we'd have done this round
tough
back end of summer, you know, great weather, sales through the roof. So anyway, we decided beginning of January, in fact, end of last year, we said, right, we're definitely going to do the raise now. Not ideal timing to do it in middle of dry January, in the middle of winter. But we did feel like we were bucking the trend in comparison to most businesses. Like, we just beat our budget for the year, almost tripled in size in terms of revenue.
Yeah.
You know, like,
there's a good story there.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we said, let's do it. Like, let's our aim is to raise between 750 and a million. We said straight away that we want this to be, we're lucky, we have an amazing cap table. I've talked about a lot of them already.
Yeah.
They've all been very supportive throughout the process. We wanted to go after a couple of new angels that we've always been quite discreet about fundraising whenever we've done it. Like, I see it as a bit of a necessary evil more than this thing to, like, shout about and brag about.
I love it.
I'm sitting on a podcast right now talking about
No. But I know where it's going
and
I love it, because I completely agree with you. Like, I think that not every bit of good news is good news, and not every bit of news needs to go in the fucking grocer either. Like, for you guys, absolutely, it's a monumental amount of money, but it's also the way that you've done the campaign, and it's a monumental bit in your business. But if you're raising smaller amounts to just get to the next stage, it's not, it's a lifeline, not a headline. Do you know what I mean?
And this is why the only reason we even decided to, or the only reason we were willing to make this a bit more public knowledge and not sort of do it fairly discreetly, is that we wanted to make the whole mission or objective of the round. I haven't talked about this at all yet. I've obviously talked glowingly about Lucy, but we are a very proudly female co-founded business, 80% female run, already 40% female owned. We have, before this round, we already have 15 female angel investors. So
amazing.
We have a female tone of voice as a brand. Yeah. We assume our audience is majority female. Like, I always feel like a bit of a fraud as a bloke sitting here saying that. All those things are true, right?
Yeah.
What we wanted to do in this round is, the mission of it, or the objective of it, was to encourage more women to become investors generally, but especially investors in a female-led, female-forward business, right?
Yeah.
This idea and this sort of execution came from something that happened in a round we did in 2021, which was, we got about 80% of the way through a round and we realized, despite everything I've just said, that it was nearly all men, in fact, all men who were participating in that round. And we said, whoa, hold your horses here. We need to address this. So we did two things at the time. We did a still fairly discreet social media post that just said, where are the female angels at? So we just seeded it very quietly into the world and said, know any female angel investors? We want some.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was, we said to our team, we said, if there were to be one person, one woman that you think we should approach or try and get to become an investor in our business, who would it be? And the team thought about it for a little while and they came back and all agreed on the name Grace Beverly.
Yeah.
So I think I'd seen Grace maybe once or twice before. I didn't really know who she was. So amazing founder and CEO of Tala and Shreddy, absolute baller, influencer, over a million followers, 24 years old.
Mental. 24 years old.
Yeah, she might be mental. 25 now, but when we first met her, she was 24. And and so we just got in touch, I think via Instagram, or like, we ended up speaking to her PA and she said, oh yeah, send the deck across. I'll put it in front of Grace, see what she thinks. Okay, cool. Grace wants to chat. Can you do a video call on Thursday, whatever?
Yeah.
We were on the phone with her for 20 minutes, talked her through the deck, and she was like, I love it. I want to be involved.
Great. So amazing.
That having happened, we realized it was a total lap drop. Like, you know, we could do that 100 times again and it wouldn't work.
But
that was a really cool example of how, you know, going back to this thing, like, you've got to make it work, got to get out there and hustle, ask for things that you don't think are reasonable, and, you know.
But I think it's, I think one thing that you've really like jumped over too quickly there is it's genius that you went to your team.
Yeah.
Because you involved it. That a lot of founders wouldn't, like, there's a, and I think this is where, what you guys have done, and I find so inspiring what you've done, is you have, and I know you're about to come on and talk about this, but you have incorporated a fundraise into a brand campaign.
Yeah.
And normally they're two completely different things. Mm-hmm. They're
Exactly, like I just said, right? But normally we wouldn't even want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And now we're leading front and center as a
brand campaign.
Yeah.
I love it.
So that's what we decided. As part of this round, we wanted the objective and ambition of it to be to encourage more women to get involved. Now, clear distinction there is, like, we're not excluding men from this round in the same way that we don't exclude men from being consumers of our product. We just buck the trend by saying, I assume, you know, we're gonna have a female tone of voice and we're gonna talk assuming that 51% or more of our consumers of our media are women, right? Same thing here. So that was really cool. We did it essentially through some angel investors, existing cap table, and then we ran a crowdfunding campaign, and that was where the main bulk of this mission was going to be achieved, right? So I've always wanted to do crowdfunding. I love the idea that it democratizes the investment process. Any consumer goods business that's sort of not willing to have consumers on their cap table, I think, you know, doesn't really make sense to me. I love that BrewDog have executed it really well.
Yeah, it's class.
So I've always wanted to do it, but I also acknowledge that, like, you have to, you know, it's a lot of work and you have to put yourself out there and, you know, show everyone under the bonnet and, you know, every competitor we have requested the pitch deck.
Of course
they did. I do it to everyone.
So
that was, so, but the whole ambition of it was, and the whole, as you said, the whole kind of communication, everything we did about it was, let's encourage more women to invest in the business. And then we ended up with something like 350 investors and raised just under 1.2.
Amazing.
And the usual breakdown between men and women on crowdfunding, on Seeders at least, is 80-20. And we are as close as can be to 50-50, which has been really cool. Yeah, so think about that. Like, that's 150% more women got involved in our round than normally get involved in Seeders rounds, which is really cool. Yeah,
yeah, it's amazing.
So that was nice.
It's amazing. And I love how overtly targeted that's been. And it's not only addressing big issues in society, but it's also leaning in on our consumers are female, so let's go after them.
Yeah.
It's wonderful how that's been executed in a really tactile way that it doesn't come across as holier than thou, which is so nice.
That's the thing. I'm glad you say that, and I appreciate that, because there's a really fine line to navigate, I think, when it comes to all this kind of stuff.
Definitely.
Whether it's I think food and drink disruptors have a really tough job to extol the virtues of why what you're doing is great without making an enemy of the status quo. So, like, I've sat here and talked about how I feel, you know, that the wine industry was a bit stuck in its ways and that it wasn't addressing, you know, a need state quite well enough. But I never trash talk the wine bottle.
Of course.
Like, the wine bottle is the perfect way to consume wine with people over dinner, whatever it might be. Like, we try and never trash talk.
Whatever the opposite is. It's a different experience, isn't it?
Exactly. But it goes for everything, right? Same way I just said, like, we're trying to encourage more women to be investors. We're not trying to discourage men.
We're trying to
encourage more women.
Yeah.
Same, you know, we did a whole sort of Canary Wharf takeover. We did some billboards there and the team went out with what they called, like, picket signs.
Mm.
And again, it was just like, did you know that only 14% of angel investors in the UK are women? Like, that's just, there's no enemy to that point. You know what I mean?
That
isn't
fact.
That isn't saying, fuck you, 86%.
It's just saying,
doesn't that suck?
Yeah.
And I think that's a fine line that businesses need to try and navigate. And I think the same thing happens with the sort of, you mentioned the word worthy or virtue signaling, which is that you know, there's always a flavor of the month that becomes the enemy. For a long time, it's been plastic now, right? Or the opposite, which is that carbon emissions. Carbon emissions is like the only buzzword that people think about in the context of environmental values. But like, there are way more, like, it's not just that. Like, I think people can get a bit caught up in being like, oh, I'm only on this, and if I can do enough to...
Definitely.
So, yeah, I think that's quite important.
But I think then every challenger brand goes after that. And then suddenly you're just another brand that saves fruit and veg or whatever the next flavor of the month is. And I think what's really lovely about what you guys have done and what every brand craves to have as they grow is that individuality. Like, what are Nice known for outside of their product? And how do people engage with the brand? I think it's brilliant, man.
That, I'm going to pick up that point as well, because I think that's, again, a tricky one that we try and navigate, is that canned wine especially, it addresses a consumer occasion-based need state. And it addresses the fact that the status quo is being served in plastic bottles. And so for us, like, the can of wine, first and foremost, it addresses that pain point for them. Secondly, it addresses a like wider environmental pain point. That plastic is, all plastic ever made is still here.
It's mad.
But as you say, like, so we have environmental credentials, but they're not the first thing. The first thing is creating like really good tasting products. In packaging and at a price point that people want to engage with. And then the fact that it's better for the planet is then like a hygiene factor. I think people are going to wake up in 10 years and any business that's not is dead already.
100%. So it's the T's and C's.
Exactly. Exactly. It can't be your differentiator, I don't
think. No, I agree. And if you'd gone after that, you'd end up with the that tertiary brand you were talking about before that was just like... I think it's amazing, mate. And I think it's the same as what we're trying to do now with healthy snacking, is for the longest time, brands have over-communicated the health elements. You don't need to now, because consumers are expecting it. It's the emotion that you feel from a brand, right, that that people dig in with. Mate, I could literally sit here all day and talk to you, but I'm conscious of time, both your time and our time. I want to, as we start to wrap up, what's next for Nice, and where can consumers reach out and find you guys?
Yeah, so in terms of where you can find Nice, the best places for that are, we're in nearly full distribution in Sainsbury's, so you can buy all of our canned wine in Sainsbury's. You can grab us on Ocado, Amazon, our website. If you're ever at any festivals this year, that we're going to be doing just over 200 festivals.
Amazing.
We just literally yesterday won the contract to supply Twickenham going
for Hey, pretty cool. Amazing.
Yeah, exactly. We have a few other stadiums that we're in. And then
is that Gary Sheck? Is he still Twickenham?
I haven't been involved in it, so I don't know if it's Gary, but that's not the person we've been working with. We're in 2022 we launched Wine on Tap for the first time, and that's been really, really cool. So expect to see that popping up in loads more of the more traditional on trade, so pubs, bars, restaurants, kind of places. The place that most nice wine gets consumed is Virgin Atlantic. So if you're ever flying on Virgin, we're the only wine on board for all of their economy and premium economy passengers. It's free on board, so you can get a little freebie. That's been really cool for us.
I can imagine
every plane globally. It's a contract to the end of 2025, and they've been the most amazing business to work with. It still feels like a family-run business.
So cool.
They like value partnerships, long-term. You know, I just love everything about their business. It's really cool.
And so I was at Bread and Jam. I think it was Bread and Jam a couple of weeks ago.
Oh yeah, Harry was there.
Was there, and she used you guys as an example of like just where it makes complete sense.
Yeah,
you guys doing all the brand piece, but logistically. Just makes
sold a pain point
sense.
For them, right? Exactly. Like, and that comes back to this whole thing about putting consumers and customers first. That's such a great story. You know what? That is another really challenging moment that we had to find a way to overcome. And I've shared this with them, so they know this story already. Which is that we face this challenge. Like we have two sizes of can, 250ml and 187. And the 187 is very specific to wine, because it has to be a quarter of a bottle. It's the strange EU law.
Okay, right,
And so our can manufacturer after a year of us having launched, they launched that for the first time. So we knew we wanted it because all other wine miniatures comes in that size. So we launched it, and but they only ever do productions of that can on a demand led basis. We had COVID, all the stuff went away, and they said, look, we're probably not going to do another can manufacturing campaign for this size queue. And we're like, oh my God, you're joking. We've just gone and sold it in all over the place. And but they said, look, if you can get your volumes up to 2 million cans, then we'll run this production run, because we've got a few others that want to do it. And at the time, I mean, we must have had a tenth of that volume actually like planned and knew where it was going to go. And we just thought, got to do it, haven't you? We got to take that risk. All in, we had enough cash to cover it if it really hadn't gone well.
Yeah.
But I just figured that will act like a bit of a moat for us. Like us being the only ones to have that can available, it's going to give us a bit of a head start on loads of stuff,
sure,
right? Then I remember, I always talk about shower moments. Like I do my clearest thinking when I'm in the shower.
Yeah.
Or midnight thoughts. Those are the two things. So a bit of a shower thought. I was like, what are we going to do to make sure just categorically that we have enough demand for these cans? And that we'd known for ages that like, My view always was one of the airlines is going to be the first to drop plastic. They're all nervous to do it, but one of them's going to be the first. So why don't we try and approach them all? Because we've been in contact with them before, and say exactly that to them. Like, look, we know you're all nervous to do this, but you're thinking, are we brave enough to do it? I'm thinking, are you brave enough to wake up in 3 years and still be putting 2 million plastic bottles in the ground? We got in touch with Virgin. It was just perfect timing. They were looking at this sustainability project to try and remove single-use plastic on board. And lo and behold, we call them, right?
Amazing.
All right. And then they're like, can you do 2 routes for 6 weeks? Yeah, of course. 2 weeks later, get a call. Like, we've been thinking about this internally. And actually, would you have enough stock if we wanted to put you on every route globally for six months? And I was like, if you'd have asked me that 2 weeks ago, no.
Yeah.
If you'd asked me in 2 weeks, you know, if we hadn't done that production run, we'd have no chance.
Amazing.
As it was, we were the only ones in the world with all that
care. Yeah.
The rest is history. Like, we never looked back. That, and so,
amazing.
Yeah, that was really.
And the volumes that come off airlines are just obscene, right?
Yeah.
Especially
when it's free issue on board.
Talking
millions of cans a year.
It's
really cool.
Nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, mate, amazing.
Sorry, I just have a tangented there.
No. But I think it's great. And I can't believe I didn't bring that up earlier, because I think that it's a classic example. I mean, our audience is predominantly challenger brands. So it's great to hear a classic example of like. And I think also, like, before we do wrap up, just really quickly, timing is really undervalued in brand world evolvement, NPD. Like, big brands will develop NPD to hit range reviews.
Yeah.
So get to know when those range reviews are, right? Like, if you contacted Virgin a month after and they'd already found a solution, you weren't going on board, right?
Exactly,
it's crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. And when you say timing, like, there's a couple of inferences to that. One is sometimes the timing just needs to be right. Like that Virgin scenario.
Yeah.
We didn't know their range of views. We just were lucky.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is a kind of testament to persistence.
Yeah, definitely.
And we had one of these examples earlier today, right? So we've been trying to get hold of a buyer from one of the train lines for like months and months and months.
Yeah.
No response.
Yeah.
We do this thing called attention grabs every quarter, I think it is, right? So the most recent one we did is we took Tony's Chocolate Only, you know, you can do like your own branded version of it, right?
Yeah.
Pink block of chocolate says, for this Valentine's, all we want is a meeting with you.
Yeah,
sent 20
love
of them
it.
Out, let's say.
Love it. Yeah.
And just today, we've had a response from them saying, I'm so sorry it's taken me so long to come back to you. Loved the chocolate, such a creative idea. Been meaning to email you back. Here's a range review window. You're getting involved. It's like,
nice.
Love that. Because you can feel like you're so often pushing water uphill.
Yeah.
And then every now and then something like that just happens. You go,
It's so amazing, isn't it? And,
and
it goes back to your point as well, I think, when we first started talking on today, is like, for your Sainsbury's buyer, you're a speck on the shoe.
Yeah.
For your train buyer, you're a speck on the shoe. For the majority of buyers in the challenger world, you are a minuscule part of their day.
Mm.
And being comfortable and okay with that is what leads. Then because then you become persistent, and then persistence and charm. I remember Alex Wright telling me, and we both worked at Cause and
the
Press
biggest
together,
charmer of them all.
We both worked at Cause and together, and he consecutively we were both told to fuck off by this Benugo buyer.
Yeah.
And we both learnt, like, he got told to fuck off first, and then he passed it on to me, both in the sales team, and then I got told to fuck off because we were just every day calling him. And there's like persistence, and then there's just being fucking annoying.
Exactly,
and you've got to find that balance.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. You have to learn it the hard way.
Oh, mate, and it's quite hard. Yeah, exactly. And after that, Causden went in that, and we had a good relationship with him afterwards. Yeah. But it's okay, cool. So yeah, they can find you there. And you personally, if people want to reach out, LinkedIn, is that the best?
Hinge profile, LinkedIn.
didn't someone, am I making this up? Didn't someone recognize you on Hinge from being a co-founder? No. I swear I heard this somewhere. Like, yeah, that's amazing.
My biggest marketing channel.
That's so good.
No, I'm joking.
I love it.
Yeah, LinkedIn, Instagram. Don't look on there too much, but yeah.
Great. Great. Mate, I love your Instagram stuff. I think it's hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Did you see my Instagram at the weekend?
I did, with Karen. I think it was wonderful.
I've started getting a bit active on LinkedIn as well, just sort of like,
I love
it. What was the one I did? I did one the other day, which is about, I don't know, but you must get this as well. The amount of junk email I get.
Yeah.
And it's been annoying me for ages. I've had a post building up, and then I got one on this Friday afternoon, and it said, like, title was quick Q, as it always is.
Yeah.
Can't be bothered to write the whole word question.
Yeah.
Then they're going to write me a five, you know.
Yeah, copy and paste.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there was no question in the whole thing, and it had all this bollocks in it. Anyway, I pasted that. And then also I did like a mock, I did a piss take of a LinkedIn post the other day.
I love it.
They're all the same.
I saw it. I love it. Yeah. And so ironically, it got so much engagement. Like, it was
I know.
So good.
And I knew it would. That's the thing. I was like, I'm going to just basically trash, you know.
I love it. And
do the tongue in cheek.
And I've followed it for a while because your stuff that you post is fucking hilarious. During COVID, when you guys had when you branded that
van,
and the back and forth with your neighbor, man, that was like my daily form of entertainment.
That was like, amazing. I think you can go back and you can find stories, can't you?
Oh, mate, please do.
I might make it.
Do, because it was like
the highlight of that. It was so funny, wasn't it?
It was fucking hilarious.
He completely lost his head. I just leaned into it. So funny, yeah.
Love it, because in all of this, in the high stressful environment you put yourself in, like, being able to just step out and be like, fuck off, Karen, have a breath. So good.
Take a breath.
Just don't take yourself too seriously. I love it.
Yeah.
Mate, look, thank you so much for coming on. I've got to ask you one thing. We've got we're doing this now for the new series. So I'm hosting a dinner party. Mm-hmm. There's one person in the whole world you can bring. So far, by the way, it's Spag Bowl, so it's a mean homemade cooked dinner. We've got Gary Neville, Stu from Manny Life chose Gary Neville, Woodsy from Liana Collection chose Phil Knight.
Mm.
Who are you bringing?
I think I'm going to bring Elon Musk.
Nice.
Yeah,
I like that.
Do you want some explanation as to why?
Yeah,
I'm absolutely fascinated by him for a start. Like, I think he. I actually love him. I know it's a bit of an unpopular opinion.
Yeah.
But I think his intentions are actually broadly in the right place.
Yeah.
He's a complete space cadet, don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
but like, I've listened to some podcasts of his, I've read some stuff about him where, like, I like that his basic raison d'etre is that if I can just build businesses that help improve the world, then the financial gain that comes with that is a bit of a secondary factor.
Yeah.
And I just think he's like a real, I think he would be a phenomenal dinner party guest.
Yeah, I agree.
For all those reasons.
It'd be
I think he roughs people up the wrong way, and he's really clever and he's funny. So yeah, I'd have him along.
It'd be fascinating. I remember I saw a clip just really quickly. I saw a clip on I can't remember where it was, and it was him speaking, and someone was talking about like an underwater car, like a submarine car, and he literally just looks them dead in the eye, and he's like, I think it's a bit niche. Like, it was like,
so
there
classic.
Was just no, like, it was just amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, right, great. So we're adding Elon Musk.
Got Elon in.
How cool would it be, man, if that's never going to happen, but if we could have 13, but at the end of this series, we've got 13, 14 guests. If we could make it happen, we're never going to be able to make
it. Yeah, I don't know how.
Disclaimer.
I don't know how Gary Neville and Elon are going to get on.
But I think it's going to be quite a fun project. Anyway, Jeremy, thank you so much for coming on Told, mate. It's been a pleasure to catch up, and it's been great to have you you on. And
thank you for having me.
No, absolute pleasure. Listeners, thank you so much for your time. Please do download, get involved, share it with your mates, your mates' mum. And we'll catch you next time. That's all for now. Take care. All the best. Ta-da. Thank you so much for giving us your time and listening. I really hope you've enjoyed. If you have enjoyed, please, please, please do download, subscribe, tell your friends' friends, tell your friend's mum's dog. It all really helps us grow the podcast, ultimately bring on more guests, which will be able to get us to give across more tangible takeaways. Thank you so much again. I'm Harry Turpin, your host, founder of The Savourists. We love you lots. Take care. Keep jingling.